if your valuation hasn't gone up an order of magnitude over the course of the last, decade plus, Occam's razor would probably say you're not doing something right. And to your point about the intranet, I mean, we have a special opportunity with the modern era of technologies to insert something new in the enterprise software stack that will live above all of your existing systems of record, that will be completely agnostic to the human language that things are authored, recorded, or captured in. It's not going to matter what system of record that they're in, and it's not going to matter what the underlying object type is, whether it's audio, video, images, text. It's not going to matter if it's structured, semi-structured, or unstructured information. You're going to be able to drop a prompt at the top, and through all manners of multi-hop capabilities, you'll get your search and discovery done. Then it'll trigger workflows, and then it'll eventually be able to do automation.
Hello, and welcome to Fireside with VC. My name is Andrew Romans, and I'm delighted to be with my old friend, venture partner, actual LP in our fund going way back to our earliest funds, and now portfolio company, Igor Jablokov, who's the founder of Prion. Igor, great to see you.
Thanks for having me, Andrew.
Yeah, so quick background on Igor. We go way back. I knew him when he was the founder and CEO of Yap, which was so early into really natural language processing, NLP, that it didn't really have an acronym for it, or the space wasn't defined yet. And we were even talking about it like it was a voice recognition company, because that was something that people knew from like Dragon Software and, lawyers dictating into a dictaphone into kind of text. And Yap was later acquired by Amazon, and it actually became the nucleus of what is today Alexa and Fire TV and a whole bunch of suite of their products. So there really wouldn't be Alexa at Amazon had it not been for Igor's invention at Yap. Prior to that, Igor was in charge of a research group at IBM, which later became Watson, and was involved with multimodal web browsers, where we still don't really have like kind of Skype-esque voice and video embedded into the browser the way it should. You know, crypto probably should have been born in the web browser for payments. So Igor's been around of a lot of the greatest minds. And I've known Igor for so long that he was bouncing ideas in coffee shops in Silicon Valley for Prion from the very earliest of days. I was a little concerned when he was hiring the smartest people, because these people cost money. But, you know, just on the recruiting side of Prion, it's been an interesting journey. So we're going to get into all things artificial intelligence today. We're going to talk about Prion, but we're also going to talk about the industry on a global basis, industry and so forth. So, Igor, why don't you tell us, what does Prion do? Pryon, Prion. What does the company do and why did you create it?
Yeah, we're building the world's first knowledge cloud. You know, it's essentially when I look at the opportunity before us, it's that there wasn't one unified repository of knowledge inside of these organizations, and yet we have them on our college campuses and in our civic communities known as libraries, and yet there wasn't this unification of knowledge. And so on a day-to-day basis, everybody in the organization feels friction, you know, in terms of, you know, finding the things that they need to know in order to perform different workflows. And so there's an opportunity for a new layer above the existing enterprise software stack, where you'll drop natural language prompts at the top, and essentially it will traverse all manners of system records that you have with untold object types, audio, video, images, text, structured, semi-structured, unstructured knowledge, and pull it all together for you in a sub-second response time.
So what are some, first of all, when did you start Prion? How long has the journey been with this one?
Yeah, this started in 2017, in the early part of 2017. And as you mentioned already, you know, that wasn't our first rodeo vis-a-vis dealing with natural language interactions. You know, I did lead as program director, an early multimodal research team at IBM where we discovered the baby version of Watson, and they didn't want to green light it. It was ahead of its time, even though we were trying to hide it in hospitals and college campuses. Heck, we even had an incarnation of it in Epcot Center in Disney World for people to cross paths with. And in my frustration, I departed, recruited folks, as you mentioned, from Dragon, from IBM VioVoice, from NVIDIA, from Intel, from Broadcom and the like, from Microsoft, pulled them together. And we became the world's first AI cloud company, you know, with dozens of enterprise and carrier customers, including Sprint and Microsoft. We had almost 50 million users on our platform. Within a year, I believe, of founding the company, because we had some of the early engineers that worked on the iPod on staff, we back-channeled into Apple and we prototyped a version of Siri before the iPhone even existed. That's how Wow. early they were even thinking about natural language interaction and AI assistance. And then you're exactly right. Half a decade later, we were secretly acquired by Amazon to develop Alexa for them. Alexa is my older sister's name, which is a total coincidence. And Prime was the code name. So that's where it came from.
Oh, so Prime was the code. That's right. It was the code name for Alexa. That's pretty cool. Well, so your hard work continues. Tell us a little bit about the funding of the company. Because, you know, like I said, in the early days when you were talking about who your first hires were, I was like, ooh, I got to be careful with our fund money because, as you know, we're kind of capital efficient company. And then I just couldn't resist knowing about this from before it happened and not being on your cap table. So thank you very much for letting us invest. But who are some of the bigger players? I mean, I know, of course, but maybe share with us some of the people you recruited into the orbit of the company on the cap table investor side.
Yeah. So, I mean, we essentially have the same backers that took the quantum computing division out of Google. So it's Thomas Tull, Jim Breyer, Eric Schmidt. Our Series A was co-led by Jim Breyer and Steve Case's fund in DC area. So known as Rise of the Rest. It's been great working with them since practically inception. And, you know, they're strategic investors. So Stanford University, Micron's AI Fund, Duke University, folks affiliated with the University of North Carolina, you know, a mess of strategics that are part of this as well. Two Sigma Ventures, Graycroft, Digital Alpha, so, which is majority backed by Cisco. So there's been a good, you know, consortium that built around us. Technically speaking, we're a fairly capital efficient AI company when you see some of the, you know, bulking up that other folks had to do even to deliver the same level of capability that we've done. Probably, you know, an order of magnitude less to achieve the same outcome here in terms of investment. So there's a couple of different ways animals can evolve in nature, either in a rainforest or in a desert, but they're still both alive.
Right. And from our earliest conversations, I always felt like sometimes I think in general, you can generalize that it's the job of the founder to recognize all the applications of their technology and how it could be applied to everything from military to education, healthcare, just everything. And it's often the job of the VC, as painful as it sounds, to try to focus that founder on some use cases that will either save money and make money for the customer and kind of price this in a way that there's good adoption and you see kind of revenue growing quarter over quarter, year over year. And then maybe over time you can get into more of the many other horizontal applications. But where did you choose to focus your energy and even the sales team now that you know, this is a real company with real high velocity on the revenue side? What's a specific application so we can maybe touch it in a little bit more granular sense here?
Yeah, curiously, there are several different mental models to use. The first thing that I tell our team is look, you need to embrace the fact that for a decade, we're going to be obscure and nobody's going to know we exist because things don't really become household names. If you think about early DocuSign, early Twilio, early Cloudflare, early any one of these things that becomes an entrant in the enterprise software stack or helps even define a category like an Okta. You know, that's something that takes a long period of time. So I'm like, for a decade, nobody's going to know where you work. So make peace with that. You know, when you're talking to friends and family members that work at Apple, the Google, and the rest of it, and they're like, Prion who? They've never heard, of such a place. And then the one of the ways that I think about this stuff, if you think about it as a strategic plan for a decade, it actually breaks down into three rough periods of time. The first period of time that I call the checkers phase takes about 3 years. That's your all you're doing is hiring R&D and product. You're worried about essentially doing your MVP, right? So in our case, it required a fairly robust R&D team in order to construct this thing because we wanted to own the full stack for ourselves. But that's what period one represents. The second period, that's a chess phase. This is when you have to have your product market fit. So you got to get your early reference customers in order to start showing that the product that you develop is relevant to a market. And then phase three is what I consider the go phase. This is where you have an MVP as product market fit, and now you're scaling, right? You're looking for partners, you're training folks and things of that sort. You're bulking up with government affairs folks and solutions folks and things of that sort. You start making certain more exotic hires at that point in time where you're trying to figure out, all right, now we're building for growth. What's our path towards becoming an IPO-able company and standing on our own two legs? And just know that 10-year time horizon, less than 13% of companies ever get to 10 million ARR and above. Now, one of the things that actually has helped us traverse these different periods is, of course, you need great rank and file personnel, but also leadership. So in phase one, I was able to recruit as our chief scientist, David Nahamu, who's considered a world leader, an IBM fellow in natural language processing and human language technologies. And so he helped kickstart the formation of our technology team. And in Act Two, we were able to recruit Chris Small, who was one of the early Oracle executives that Benioff brought in to help him run go-to-markets from year two through the IPO as well. So in each of these phases, there's different styles of leadership that are relevant, to those scenarios, and luckily we were able to address that.
Well, so at a high level, I remember you showing me like literally a web browser with a folder. And you could just grab proprietary information that an enterprise has and like drop it in there, almost like the manual for a BMW X7. And then once it's in there, you should be able to like hit that little button on your steering wheel and say, hey, what kind of oil does this car take anyway? And could you send it to my phone? As opposed to open the glove compartment and fish out a manual. But like, give me an example of an actual customer and how they are using Prion, and what's the value they're getting to be paying Prion an enterprise software license for this?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different examples. I mean, there's an entity in Big Pharma that's using it for sales enablement content. So all of their sales and BD folks, have the latest information possible about their products, processes, and things of that sort. That's one example. So that's more of a revenue accelerator play, right? Which sells well to CROs.
It's also in the pharma world, it's also accuracy, compliance, it's almost having programmatic compliance of if there's side effects from a drug being discovered in the clinic or with users, it's immediately kind of published on these are the side effects. I mean, that's sort of a natural progression of where humankind is evolving to, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. There's a whole myriad of use cases. Actually, connecting to the last question that you asked, Chris joked that I did SaaS backwards in some ways because we went after the biggest and baddest organizations on planet Earth as our early reference customers as well. While most founders are going to go after, SMBs and then, crawl to the mid-market and then eventually do enterprises and then they'll do multinationals and then they'll do government agencies last, I kind of went backwards and just started from the biggest and baddest orgs first because I felt that that's a gauntlet you go through. And if you can survive that, everything else becomes down market And when those references become public, everybody starts saying, "Oh gosh, I want the same stuff that an NVIDIA has. I want the same stuff that an Air Force has." Right? That's the good stuff, and they end up trusting it, and they end up solving their own questions. I remember being in a hospital environment, and one executive was asking another, "Do you think this Prime thing is good enough to work in our secure environment, in our private environment?" And the other one chirped up before I even was able to answer the question and said, "Yeah, they're in nuclear reactor sites. We're going to be okay."
Okay. So just give a few examples of how Prime, benefits a customer today.
Yeah, so NVIDIA, when you actually get support for your GeForce and Mellanox style devices, it's actually Prion's knowledge cloud that provides those answers. So to you, it appears like an NVIDIA branded bot, but every time you type something in there, it's making an API call out to one of the collections that they built on Prion's platform. So that's an example. Another example would be
And
World
is
Economic.
that human supervised or is it pure?
Pure automation. Yeah, I'm
Okay.
not in all RLHF nonsense, where people don't know if they're unintentionally spilling stuff and it's going overseas for corrections. I think that's inappropriate for most enterprise uses. People are expecting the automation to hit, and then it goes over to your contact center if it goes out of domain or if there's an escalation. That's the way that people typically think of adopting these in enterprise scenarios.
And talk about what is the technical process of getting a customer onboarded and up and running. I remember you showing me like just drag and drop stuff that you were dropping stuff into a folder, and
Yeah.
then you could ask a question to the system. And early days of thinking about NLP, natural language processing, is the ability to understand the word bank in this context could mean riverbank, not Bank of America, right? So, how does an enterprise customer adopting Prion get the information into the system, and is there a training period? What does this all look like?
No, they could be up and running same day. I mean, it literally takes longer to, get through procurement, legal, compliance, and things of that sort, but they could be launched same day. I mean, so for example, we have a, public cloud multi-tenant environment. So what we do on our end, we press a button and we generate an org for them. And then it's a simple three-step process. They connect to their single sign-on provider. So that's how their user administration is in sync with their enterprise. Then they create a read-only connection to an underlying repository, such as SAP ServiceNow, Salesforce, something like Box folders or SharePoint or S3 buckets or Zendesk. Maybe they have some Vimeo files. Maybe they have some YouTube files. Maybe they have an S3 bucket somewhere, or there's some web pages they want to ingest. And then step three is they literally hit the plus button on our platform to create a new knowledge app. They point to one or more sources of unstructured knowledge. These are repositories full of, PDF files, Word files, web pages, PowerPoints, and the like. And then it automatically builds the AI model in front of their very eyes. And as soon as it's done, you can immediately start talking or typing into it. So it's like your own private GPT, but it's anchored to the sources and methods and documentation that an organization trusts.
And so, if the user manual for whatever is being ingested, does that mean there is less frequency of hallucinations? Like where do you see hallucinations or bad information popping out of these models?
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of the picks and shovel crowd are telling everybody to make their own LLMs or fine-tune open source models and things of that sort. Most companies either don't have the sophistication for that, or you're always going to be on a bug hunt to try to guardrail these things. And that's what any of these organizations want to do, especially if they're in highly regulated industries. So for us, the only universe is the content that an organization trusts. That's one of the four P's, meaning Is there publicly available content from academic institutions or government organizations that they want to bring in? Is there published content that they've properly licensed from outside parties that they want to bring in? Is there proprietary content unique to them? So it's IP that is only for their use, or is there personal content that's just unique to you as an end user? And so they can choose any one of these four Ps and create the knowledge app that then they can either leverage using our portal, our mobile experiences and the like, or every single one of them that's born gets an API key associated with it so they can wire it into an existing chatbot, into an assistant, into a digital human. They can have it automatically answering emails. They can have it answering, you know, questions coming in from an interactive voice response unit. They have a lot of choices in terms of the consumption channels that they want the knowledge app to power.
I love the way it's also multimodal. Obviously, it's been your mindset for so long, and that's the reality of the world we're in right now. Like, let's kind of lift the helicopter up a bit away from Prion and think more of like, how do you understand the AI world? Like, what are from an OSI model, what are the different layers that are out there, from like data lakes to your Sam Altman's OpenAI? And then we could talk more on like a global stage of what's happening in different countries and at like the big fangs and maybe even the Fortune 500 and where we see this is going, even on a regulatory safety side. So what do you view as the different like components to the industry?
Yeah, well, I mean, the goodness is we've been trying to shield folks from components. This is almost like opening up a Volkswagen and seeing that they have a plastic shroud over the engine, because they're like, most people don't know how to caretake one of these things. So they don't want them to get in trouble beyond adding, windshield wiper fluid. And that's about all you can do inside of their engine. So they're, you know, to build an anti-prion requires you to do what? To build an anti-prion. You know, if you want to build your own version of it from scratch, right? There's a lot of parts vendors out there. And so you have to get a vector database. You got to get an entity extraction capability. You got to get speech recognition. You got to get OCR, handwriting recognition. Then you got to get model management. Then you got to get an IRQA engine in there. Then you got to get a foundation model of some sort. There's so many piece parts, or you can just buy the iPhone, right? So, you know, people don't walk into an Apple store, you know, talking about what does the OSI stack look like. They're like, look, I just want to plink some money down and solve this knowledge friction. I know I'm mixing metaphors here between what we do and they do, but we really did take an Apple-esque approach to solving this problem. That's why I hired UX folks from Apple, product managers from Google. I worked with behavioral scientists. I worked with, chief of lessons learned officers, you know, from different government agencies and the like, to say, what would it look like if I was able to do the same job as a Databricks, as a Palantir, as a Snowflake, but I put it in such a packaging that's so candy coated and leverages the muscle memory of some of the existing consumer AI brands that you've experienced in the past that we had some hand in building and birthing. And it was just simple to use, where instead of you having to figure out how to train your own LLM or fine-tune models, you were able to just point to content and it just automatically generated it on its own, and you immediately started using it. So we've been really thinking about how to democratize access to these style of technologies to make it as stupid simple to operate as you creating a new Slack channel or you creating a new Teams channel.
There's a lot of, there's sort of where's the kind of generative AI or NLP and mining databases and siloed pockets of data and then packaging something up. And there's kind of like the Sam Altman OpenAI approach has been a bit of like break things and ask for forgiveness later with regards to kind of copyright and intellectual property of who owns, you know, like make me holding a lightsaber and looking like Darth Vader. That's Disney owned right now, where you guys have been more allowing your customers to play with their data, right? What are your view of the world of AI illegally using, accessing data inside of a data lake? And what's your approach to that? And how do you see this playing out with different players in the industry like OpenAI?
Yeah, moving fast and breaking things doesn't work for critical infrastructure and important institutions in our communities, like hospitals.
Or the military.
Yeah, airports. First responders, power plants, water treatment plants, and things of that sort. So I call shenanigans on that drive. I get it. If you want a box of Legos or a bucket full of Play-Doh and you want to play, have at it. But when I'm in your emergency room, I kind of want facts to be emitted so that they know the best course of treatment for me. Thank you very much. So there's two different worldviews from that standpoint. I'm not trying to make an AGI. Prion was purpose built as a piece of serious enterprise software that can go into the most regulated of industries that are out there, properly logged, properly secure, properly attributable and verifiable content that gets emitted. Because remember this, people don't trust technology. People trust other people. And so when, if I ingest the body of knowledge that you've generated, right, the books that you've written, and I ask a question about, hey, what does it take to be corporate venture capital? What's the right way to approach it and interact with these startups? How do I manage the board in that relationship? How do I deal with conflicts of interest associated with our, interest with the company, but it's going to maintain some freedom of action and flexibility? And what happens if, my competitors, try to access, can I ask for first right of refusal or not? These aren't things that you just wanted to barf out. You want it to go right to the section of your book where you're describing, some of these thoughts and ideas that are properly referenced due to different case studies that you may have promoted in there, or different experiences. Like, hey, this is how this entity did it and it didn't work, or here's how this other entity did it and it ended up, doing well and everybody won. The company won and the strategic investor won in the end. This is how they got a great return, relative to others. Here's another one that didn't do all well.
That could be interesting to create, like, a web page on our website that allows CVCs or corporates to ask a question uniquely to the research and the data that went into that book. That is kind of interesting. Where do you see, why don't we talk about ethical, not ethical, by the Igor Jablokov, view of the world of, and we don't need to name any companies, but what's happening that shouldn't be happening, and how are government regulatory bodies going to regulate this? And, maybe misuse of information, and then maybe get into some of the risks and what's suitable on regulations around this super fast moving segment of the world economy. And
yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. This is why we have a head of government affairs that used to be an undersecretary in the Commerce Department that used to have Census, CFIUS, and the Patent Office reporting to him in the past as well to really help us understand these issues. He was actually the envoy to the European Union that helped negotiate the privacy shield with all the emerging GDPR stuff. And he's certainly familiar with what ended up happening in California with CCPA, and also was back channeling to the recent executive order that came out, and also working behind the scenes on what the EU's AI Act eventually will become and what it could eventually migrate to. So we're certainly aware of all of these things. I can assure you, though, none of our scientists are going on public record saying that you should be using AI for mental health support. Because one of the things that people know is, or may not know, actually, the first AI-triggered suicide already happened in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. And so these things, as we've seen in the Netflix documentary, Social Dilemma, don't have to be better than us. They just have to know how to take advantage of our weaknesses. And so you see a lot of worry by, let's say, UK, trying to figure out how they could pull the AI out of Snapchat because they figure that, too many children and teenagers are intersecting with that technology and potentially revealing private details about their lives that they shouldn't be. You have some of the bipartisan collection of attorney generals that are including the one from North Carolina, that are thinking about what package of legislation do they have to do to essentially try to prevent bullying with generative AI technologies if children are taking images of other children and essentially putting them in scenarios or saying certain things that they never did. How are they going to be able to, police against that as well? And so my worldview on ethics, of course, it's easier for us because we're working in a more serious world of enterprises that tend to be self-regulated and self-governing. But, make no mistake. I mean, big tech is the reason why they're showing up in front of Congress is they want lightweight regulation because similar banking executives will tell you they like that because it creates a moat and makes it a lot harder for new entrants to show up. But at the same time, they don't want it to be too onerous because they want to make sure that they still have a freedom of action in their gravy trains as well.
Yeah, I don't like the idea of OpenAI pulling up the ladder behind them and making it really hard for startups to enter a space with onerous regulations. The other concern is, are you throwing people into the arms of China or Europe or leaving the United States? What's your view of the landscape of progress within real AI as opposed to artificial intelligence? I mean, first of all, a lot of people just slap a name, right? Like the LPs want this, so the VCs slap that label and the startups slap that label. I'm a big data flavor of the month buzzword. But for real AI, for actual real artificial intelligence, how do you see the landscape of progress being made in Europe versus China, Asia, US, Japan? What's your perspective there?
Well, I mean, all of these environments, everybody has different strengths and weaknesses as well, whether they're more heterogeneous cultures or homogeneous cultures. When you encounter these AI companies, they tend to fall in one of three buckets, right? So here's a quick framing device. The one that's most voluminous is they're minting t-shirts, they're putting dot AI, they're high-fiving each other that they're AI people, but they're just building apps. Technically speaking, all they're doing is building apps on top of other people's APIs, right? Whether they're building on top of
Yeah.
AWS, Azure, GCP, Cohere, Anthropic, OpenAI, so on and so forth. Don't get me wrong. I mean, some of them may build really nice lifestyle business, and the rare one of them will have a breakaway success, especially if they're, targeting a narrow niche that's undiscovered, maybe supporting some industry or solution area that is being left behind. And there's going to be a lot of them. And I would say the majority of the YC com Y Combinator companies that were recently born are probably that first category. The second and the third category of these companies tend to be generationally and technologically different. The second category tend to be your wonder kids, 20, 30 somethings that don't have enough flight hours in AI yet. So they just focus on a narrow niche, meaning they'll build foundation models, they'll build dialogue managers, they'll build speech recognition, they'll build, model managers, things of that sort, vector databases, maybe in some cases. They don't really know how to connect their technology to the business yet. So they don't have a lot of credibility with the C-suite. They certainly can't talk to legal and compliance officers yet, but where they do have some credibility is with other data scientists and other software engineers that see themselves as contemporaries. And so what they'll do is try to build a developer ecosystem around themselves so they can throw spaghetti in the wall and see what sticks. I'm generally disinterested in that model because, similar to the example that I used before, that's like sending you and I into an auto zone and telling us to build a car from parts.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're really a good engineer, you can pull it off, but it's never going to have the same safety features, fit and finish, and fuel efficiency as a purpose-built Honda Accord or Toyota Camry. The third is the rarest type. Rarest type. These are more mature teams that tend to have, in some cases, decades of experience, lots of flight hours in AI. They can talk to the C-suites and the admirals and the generals and the senators and the compliance and legal teams and things of that sort. They know how to create a business case for the technology when it shows up in these environments. They know how to secure them and things of that sort. And they try to control the whole stack and build it all for themselves. Now, it requires years and a mess of financial resources to be able to do it. But guess what? It's similar to Apple's bug hunt. You know, Apple likes to vertically integrate the whole thing, building their own chips, devices, operating systems, and applications. By doing so, they get the highest level of firepower with the lowest energy use. And that's what we represent as a company. That way we can be full stack, and that way we can control our future capabilities, and we don't need a single API call out to any of the big tech folks in order to operate our business. This allows us, by the way, to control our COGS. We end up controlling accuracy, scale, security, and speed.
Yeah. 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 I think there's almost a cultural thing with the venture startup ecosystem culturally, where the VCs want the startup to make like a point solution that does one thing and then prove that they've got like positive CAC to LTV and it's all the kind of craft ventures, measurable SaaS ratios, and that the payback is either instantaneous or within 3 months, and then pour more money onto that. And if you're getting like $25,000 for 1,000 of spend, then pour in 50 million of funding to amplify that, even if it collapses from 1 to 25 to 1 to 3. And what they're failing to do is fund something that actually does that Apple end-to-end fully integrated thing that takes time, and then solve an entire workflow from start to finish thing. And so a lot of these startups that could be conceived of kind of don't really get funded, or they have to horizontally expand after having proved that they could do that one thing. So you're doing DocuSign, but you're not doing the entire real estate industry of data that says she might want to sell her house. You're just solving the one print, scan, sign, pray that they sign it on the other end, side of things. What about military? I know when we had lunch the other day, I was saying I knew from another portfolio company that the military didn't want a web-hosted cloud knowledge base that you were talking about at the beginning of this discussion here, but they want an appliance in a box, in a truck that they control, right? That's just the way the military generally thinks of my walled garden. I remember JP Morgan originally said no email addresses here for anybody at JP Morgan because nothing gets in and out of this fortress. They were kind of resisting email and then the browser, thinking a brick wall keeps it all in Fort Knox. Tell us about what the mindset is. And I know there's limits of what you can say here, but if Brian were serving the military, how does that work?
Yeah, I mean, that's why by controlling your own fate in this end-to-end system, that also means we control service delivery. And so you can have your public cloud multi-tenant incarnation of this. You can have your private cloud incarnation of this, or you can have your on-premises incarnation of it as well. And so by controlling the stack, we can basically package this in however way that these organizations need to consume it. And just realistically speaking, a lot of them are going to have, a hybrid approach where, hey, for the publicly visible stuff, we're fine with the cloud stuff. Here's mid-tier missions, we'll have to do private cloud orientation with that, where we can put a neat and tidy border around it. But it should still be able to talk to the outside world if necessary. And then for the most sensitive of content, the most unique intellectual property that we have, maybe it's big pharma, maybe it's big semiconductor and the like, certain hospital environments, they'll want it completely air-gapped and disconnected from the outside world. All of those are choices that they have with Prime's platform.
So appliance on-prem, it works, you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Cause that's not a given. It's not a given. Well, why don't we wrap up and talk about what the future looks like? So if you just talk about the Fortune 500, How is the Fortune 500 generally going to change with the adoption of technology like Prion? Where are they today at point A? And what does point B look like? Where is humanity evolving to with all of this?
Yeah, and I'll work from macro to micro, right? The macro things that Eric Schmidt has said is it appears that the internet as we know it will split into half. You know, one is going to be the Chinese worldview and the rest of us are going to be on the other side of it as well. So the internet splits in half. That's the first thing. And then the internet that we have left over, to our own devices, over a year ago, it essentially died, right? Because all of us were used to doing Google searches and seeing compositions from humanity, right? Whether it was audio, music, and things of that sort, videos, images that somebody photographed, a nice desert in Jordan and things of that sort, or all manners of text, that came out from human creativity and ingenuity. Now, with all the generative production, the world is going to be flooded with these things that we can't tell if they're real or not. And so one of the things that we foresaw as we started working in the knowledge management space is, okay, what this tells me is that similar to how in Norway, there's a seed bank that's hidden away that has all of the critical things to restore agriculture for non-GMO, from non-GMO assets, that the fallback position to the Fortune 500 is going to be that they're going to have a knowledge cloud that they administer that is their source of truth, of external and internal resources that they can trust from their, that their employees can use, their clients can use, their partners can use, that has stuff that they've properly licensed, stuff from, government agencies, academic environments, and things of that sort. And it's essentially going to end up becoming their own private internet. They're just going to have to, because to think that you can go into Google like we used to do, researching a particular topic, is going to be a no-go because you have no idea how much disinformation is going to show up.
I remember back in Mosaic 1993 days of people talking about the intranet, right?
Right.
Correct. So the intranet was sort of like, almost before the browser came out, you had HTML and you had libraries of what we got here at this company, So the intranet concept, knowledge management, I remember all the big consulting companies, the McKinsey's, were trying to say, oh man, we're going to have a multi-billion dollar practice selling knowledge management to the Fortune 500 globally. So this is more of, I guess, just all of this working a little bit better. So give an example of a company, a Fortune 500 company that, without saying a name, more like industry, that would be a victim of failure to adopt this technological change. And then an example of a company adopting this technological change and being a beneficiary of it. You kind of had Walmart versus Kmart, and Kmart failed. And that was like an HBS case that we studied in an MBA program, decades ago. Maybe, so what does this evolution look like in companies that are smarter at harnessing it? And what does it look, what does failure look like, at that big, huge corporate level?
Yeah, I mean, they say knowledge is power, but knowledge visibility truly, though, is a superpower. Meaning, there's a have and have not situation even in public markets, right? You can rest assured the ones that are hitting, valuations north of $1 trillion, they know how to wire the totality of the internet for their own purposes, right? They can predict future products to build based on, all of the intelligence that's flowing, to their corp dev, BD folks, product managers, and things of that sort. So those are obviously the ones that are doing well because you can point to their economic productivity, in terms of their adaptations to changing market conditions, whether it's AI, whether it's, geopolitical risks, whether it's, migrations to cloud and things of that sort, right? And adjacent markets that they're entering at all times, which just continually bulks them up. So if your valuation hasn't gone up an order of magnitude over the course of the last, decade plus, Occam's razor would probably say you're not doing something right, from that perspective. So that's something a little bit broader. And to your point about the intranet, I mean, we have a special opportunity with the modern era of AI technologies to insert something new in the enterprise software stack that will live above all of your existing systems of record, that will be completely agnostic to the human language that things are authored, recorded, or captured in. It's not going to matter what system of record that they're in, and it's not going to matter what the underlying object type is, whether it's audio, video, images, text. It's not going to matter if it's structured, semi-structured, or unstructured information. You're going to be able to drop a prompt at the top, and through all manners of multi-hop capabilities, you'll get your search and discovery done, then it'll trigger workflows, and then it'll eventually be able to do automation. Now, everybody assumes when they adopt AI technology, it's this godlike thing that works on day one. And that's another thing that I call shenanigans on. I'm like, no, there has to be a crawl, walk, run association with adoption of these technologies. And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, easy. Don't you get the same paid the same amount on day one in your company to day 365? And you're two different people, in that year span, even though you're getting paid the exact same amount every couple of weeks, you've been trained, you know where to find things, you can now perform certain workflows and things of that sort. And that's because the organization has tended to you to ensure that you're operating at your highest and best performance. The way you have to think about these things is not as a godlike entity, but similar to your interns, right? They show up in your environment. They don't know where anything is. So the first step that you need to prove whether they're of value to you as an eventual full-timer is you're just going to teach them how to find things. And then once they prove that they can find everything that they need to find, here's the cafeteria, here's the subject matter expert, here's where the restrooms are. Here's where these books are and manuals that you need to refer to. Then you give them lightweight workflows. And then eventually they become more complex workflows and things like that. And once they find the right thing and then do the right thing, then they end up getting autonomy. Then they end up getting authority and things of that sort. And then if you actually look at every strata of our organizations, we typically enter each job. Step one, we have to find things. Then once we find the right thing, then we do the right thing. And then once we do the right thing, people hand us more independent authority as we, float to the top. And the only difference between being an intern and being in the C-suite or being, middle managers is basically, 80% of what you do as entry level is core workflow with few exceptions. Middle managers, half their life is normal workflows, and the other half is dealing with exceptions. And then, but by the way, by the time you get to upper management, it's majority exceptions and few workflows. You're just always trying to solve, the whack-a-mole of new things that show up. And at every tier, you're going to have augmented intelligence that's going to be your wing person, helping you through these different things that you need to do. And you will become 10 times more productive. I don't think it's going to disrupt jobs, right? Because everybody's going to want to become 10 times more productive. I think it's nonsense to think about people losing jobs because everybody said computers would show up and disrupt people's jobs, and it didn't. People just expected greater productivity from us. Same thing with mobiles, et cetera.
Yeah, I think when I hear people say that, I think of like the guy saying, we're going to have to close, we should be able to close the patent office in like 2 years because we'll be done having patented everything. And that's like, no, you idiot. I kind of feel that's like the vibe I get when I think of that. If you think about kind of computers and software, they basically can read information, right? They can read information off of a device. They can write changes, right? You can write a change to the device. And then you can kind of say, if the network card gets above this temperature, then switch it off. And that stops the whole data center from crashing. So there's kind of like read, write, if, then do this. And that becomes like automation of decision tree data-driven stuff. So I think that it's not so much of like does this replace the job of 12 PhDs reading clinical trial data in Basel, Switzerland, and they've lost 12 jobs? It's about there are not enough PhDs in Switzerland to go out and read all this information and even write changes without fingerprint human mistakes on it. So I kind of think it's more about like, we can do things now and we're going to do things in the future that were just not commercially viable. Like there's not enough McKinsey people that you could pay to go through every single contract at the Home Depot and find which ones are we paying net 90 versus net 365 or whatever. So I kind of think it's interesting that you can kind of let the computer, let the software read all this, then, you know, write changes and build in this automation on stuff. But, you know, what's interesting about Prion is you provide an opportunity for the data pool, the data lake, to be a trusted source. You know what I mean? And that's ultimately, people have their primary data, like Amazon knows everything my wife is buying. You know what I mean? They've got their own, you know, first degree of data that they only uniquely have, and they could choose to share it or not share it. And then there's tapping into more. Well, listen, it's all pretty cool. A final question is, you know, before ChatGPT, a lot of people kind of didn't really know what was happening in the technology world. And now they can say, like, write a love poem for my wife's anniversary and make it rhyme, make it sound hip hop. And like, holy hell, this thing just before my eyes started writing stuff. Has that changed the sales cycle for you to get the attention of a Fortune 500 CEO? And like, when how's the sales cycle now versus how it was before, you know, the whole world heard about, you know, generative AI and all that kind of magic dust?
Yeah, I mean, you know, over a year ago, I had to try to convince investors that natural language was the metaphor that people would be interacting with, you know, to access enterprise software. And I had to spend a lot of time educating folks that was going to be the thing. And why is natural language such a big deal? Because think about it, you know, as in the past, you mentioned the hardware and software experience. There were very few of us trained as mathematicians and computer scientists, software engineers, computer engineers, and the like. And we had to speak like machines. You know, we learned assembly code, right, and different programming languages and the like in order to compel outcomes from these machines. With natural language, you kind of turn the tables around and you end up democratizing access to the superpowers of these thinking machines. And it's just as simple as dropping a prompt and getting that production out of it as well. So that did change, and history is repeating itself. One of the things that I witnessed, Andrew, firsthand in the last company, same thing. We were the first ever AI cloud company. And nobody had any idea what we were doing. But once Google Voice appeared on the scene for free, our sales skyrocketed with the service providers, with the telcos and things of that sort, because they're like, holy smokes.
It's going back to Yap.
Yeah. And we're like, hey, that's what we want for our subscribers. And we're not going to let Google take our subscribers away from us and turn us into dumb bit pipes. So now we're going to turn this into a value-added service. And then once they discovered that an average subscriber that had voicemail to text and call mining distributed on their Blackberries and similar devices was 50% less likely to churn away, they started buying us as an insurance policy. So same thing, you know, sizzle and some sells the steak. So they were able to prove that natural language is the thing, and they attracted 100 million, victims, if you will, or guinea pigs, or however you want to call these individuals that unintentionally spilled IP from their organizations and their personal lives into ChatGPT. But then these enterprises said, great, now we want that same natural language experience on top of that. And, you know, what does it look like? And it just ended up happening to look like the stuff that we were doing the last 7 years.
Well, what's pretty crazy is that, like, if you go back to early software languages, like assembly was assembling a whole bunch of commands into a command. So instead of typing all this stuff, you just type a little bit and it does it. Then you had C and C++ and Python. Now, to some extent, English or even German, whatever, the programming interface is just natural language. So, yeah. You know, make me this is no longer assembly C, C++, Python. You know, we're kind of, you know, entering, you know, a new era. So it's interesting to see how it'll play out. I'm excited that what was early conversations in 2014, 2015 and all that is turned into something that's getting real adoption and making things better. You definitely shouldn't be driving a car and opening your glove box to ask a question to a book and looking up, it's not even in the index, what the hell? And just pull right in and get the answer you want. You know, make a data-driven decision rather that humans couldn't do. So it's all pretty cool and exciting. Well, Igor, thank you so much for taking the time. You know, I'll put stuff in the show notes, but Pryon, pryon.com is probably the best way to find you. So thanks for sharing your time and knowledge here.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Bye for now. See you soon.